What we do have is a robbery in which the complainant was wounded numerous times by the assailant, who then fled the scene. The complainant, Muhammad Hamd, fortunately survived, but he was shot at least, I believe, six times, is my recollection. Six shots were heard. There were numerous wounds. After his assailant left, another employee in the store, Shorty, also known as James Dixon, identified the person that he believed had assaulted Mr. Hamd during the robbery as the appellant, and told them that the appellant had moved in recently and lived with his mother in an apartment on Hattie Street, a place that he took them to some approximately 17 minutes or so later. I suspect that, though it may have only taken a minute, as the officer described, to get from the convenience store to the apartment, I suspect setting up outside the apartment took more than a minute. Be that as it may, they had a description of the person. They had a location which was supposed to be his home. And most significantly, they knew he lived in that home with his mother.
How soon does Hot's pursuit have to occur?
I think that's a case-by-case determination, Your Honor. Obviously, this is not a continuous and actual pursuit. But since that term is used in Randolph, is in the disjunctive, I would assume that this would be a fact question for the court to determine whether this was hot pursuit, or whether this was in fact something that took a little bit more time. Now, the issues I've raised and the two constitutional points under the Fourth Amendment and Article 1, Section 9, the most expedient way to have apprehended the appellant, assuming that that's the person, would be to go into his apartment and take him. Much has happened. The problem is that police officers are constrained when entering somebody's residence to be more circumspect. They're not free to use any method that they please. Even the Supreme Court, which allows arrest without a warrant on probable cause, does not allow arrest without a warrant on probable cause if a person's home is being entered. There they require exigent circumstances, as we do by statute in Texas. If I may briefly address those and move on.
Now, was it his home?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Was it his home?
I think within the concepts of the criminal law, yes, in the sense that he lived there with a family member. It was a place that he made his residence, at least from the testimony that was available at trial. It was not something, there's no evidence, as I recall from the record, as to whether he was on the lease. I would assume that he probably was not. I would assume that it was leased and not owned. It's unlikely from looking at the pictures in the exhibit that that was a condominium. And all of these things being the case, I think you get into the rather more, shall I say, loose definition of ownership or right to be there that the criminal law applies. If it is the place that he resided, then it is his home, and he's entitled to some expectation of privacy there. Texas, of course, defines when an arrest may be effected without a warrant and a home entered and requires exigent circumstances. In this case, I think one of the most salient factual problems is contained within the testimony of Officer Williams himself, and that is the fact that a great deal is made by the officer about concern for there being a hostage or an accomplice because a wig and a purse were seen once the door flew open. Now, the officers had the option at that point to ask or demand that the appellant come out of the apartment and surrender himself. They didn't do that. They entered after him. Unlike the hot pursuit case that's mentioned in my brief, and I believe it's Sanchez, this is not a situation where the appellant was in the open doorway and in public view and then fled. He was in his house. The door flies open. Presumably he heard them announce police, but at 11:30 or so at night, it's probably not unreasonable to, if your door suddenly flies open, to flee toward the back of the house. Even if you think that it's the police, that may not be an unreasonable thing to do in that neighborhood. In addition to that, however, the officer apparently thought it was really important to base a lot of his reasoning for entry upon this suspicion that there was a hostage. And this was really sort of made up out of whole cloth by the officer. They had reason to understand before they left the convenience store that a woman lived in this apartment, because Shorty had told them before they left that Little D, the nomiker that was attached to the defendant or the appellant, that Little D lived with his mother. So there was nothing unusual about there being a wig and a purse on the coffee table, and nothing from that would inevitably lead you to a conclusion that there's a hostage present. If you turn it around and if you assume, for example, that Mr. Nixon is mistaken in his identification, then much of what the police construe as guilt-laden becomes explainable and more innocent. Now, in Texas, we define those circumstances in which an arrest may be made without a warrant by statute. And Article 1403 has, in its first two paragraphs, something that possibly could be involved as a justification for such an arrest, whether or not the defendant was in a suspicious place. The defendant was at home. That is not in and of itself a suspicious place. If it is, if anybody can make an accusation that you committed a crime and the fact that you're at home is a suspicious place, then we have rendered the limits on entry into a person's home virtually meaningless. As I've said, the hostage and the wig story is something that was pretty much made up. There was no danger of further injury to the subject.
Isn't paragraph there two. Case law that says if the police enter in an emergency situation, sort of a variation on community caretaking, it has to be totally divorced from investigative purposes, and once they determine that, I know there was a case about the woman screaming, and once she came outside, they couldn't go into the house to investigate without permission or a warrant. There's a whole line of cases.
I know there was a case within the last few years that's very similar to that. I you know, couldn't tell you what the style of it was or the site, but certainly you can't create an emergency situation out of something that's really you're seeking to arrest somebody that you think committed a crime. You know, there's no evidence here. If you look at 1404, there's no legitimate evidence here that he was about to escape. You know, he wasn't packing. He had gone home. That's not exactly where you wouldn't expect to find somebody if they returned to their home. Whether it was a prudent thing to do under the circumstances, notwithstanding, he did go home and not to some other place. So there's no evidence of fleeing. And finally, if you look at the exigent circumstances in the Randolph case that are considered.
Before you get there, let me.
Sure.
On page 9 of your brief, you say, the trial court erred in denying the motion to suppress the evidence found in the initial entry. Cap, holster, and the money. So let me ask you two questions about that. In State's brief, she says the contested evidence was later obtained by way of a judicially authorized search warrant. So, and my second question is, you've got two eyewitnesses to the shooting. What possible difference does it make if there's a cap, holster, and money? The two eyewitnesses that saw it happen identified him and told him where he lived.
Well, actually, only one of the two told him where he lived, because
the other was so badly wounded
he was taken.
They both saw it. They both saw the whole thing unfold, and one of them told him where he lived, and he did. So how do you get, what about the first question about they got this evidence you want suppressed by way of a legal warrant, and secondly, so what?
Well, they obtained the legal warrant through it's a fruit of the poisonous tree issue under Wong Sun. They would not have had the particularity necessarily for the legal warrant without having seen the cap, the holster, and the money.
Even though the two eyewitnesses saw him do it and one of them identified where he went, where he lived, that's not sufficient.
I don't think that gives probable cause necessarily. Well, that would be a determination that didn't happen. I see your point. I confess that if it's a glaring weakness here, the fact that there were two eyewitnesses that later identified him in trial does, I imagine, probably have an unfortunate tendency to inform the court's harm analysis.
Okay, that was my next question.
But, as the appellate attorney, I don't get to do the trial, cross-examination, and those issues.
So you didn't try the case?
No, sir, I did not.
Okay.
I still think that this sharpens, though, the point that I would try to make, and that is that constitutionally, some of this is bootstrapping. Yes, they went to his house where they would expect to find him. They decided to go in. There's I think, an apparent consciousness on the part of the officers that they might have a little problem with their entry under the circumstances without a warrant because of this, I think, rather excessive focus on the hostage theory, which has so little support in reality and even logic when you look at the information they had prior to going to the scene. Now, if I may briefly address the last point with respect to the request for a charge under 3823. The issue is, was there a factual dispute? Now, the Garza case suggests that that factual dispute doesn't have to come from evidence that was put forward by the defense. The factual dispute can exist in the evidence. And I would submit the factual dispute is the reasonableness of the very story that I've talked about, the hostage presence or somebody is, some other party is in the house that presented a danger or was in danger, this caretaker role, in light of the fact that the evidence before the jury, just as at the motion to suppress, was that the fact that Little Lee lived with his mother was something that had been presented to the officers before they entered. They already had reason to expect that there might be accoutrements from of a woman present or a woman present. And yet, this was the method that they used to go in. That's the factual dispute that I suggest exists that should have required the court to charge under 23, and having done so, having failed to do so, rather, Almanza would say if there's any harm, then the court should reverse the case and return it to the trial court for another trial. And that's what I would ask the court to do. If there are no further questions, I'll give you some time back.
Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Kimberly Wesley, and I'm appearing on behalf of the Tarrant County District Attorney's Office for the state of Texas. Really, Your Honor, I'd just like to open it up to questions on the first issue. With respect to the suppression issue, the state's position is that the whole issue concerns the whether there were exigent circumstances.
Do you think it was hot pursuit, or do you think, what do you think the exigent circumstances were?
We are, given the circumstances of the offense, the fact that there was a victim who had been shot multiple times, there was an armed assailant, the exigency surrounded that. We know there's a suspect.
But that's saying that any time somebody is shot during a robbery, the police can just go walk in their house without a warrant no longer, no matter how long they wait or how much time passes between the shooting and their entry into the house. So what constitutes hot pursuit? I mean, how much time do the police have between the shooting and going into the person's house and still be able to justify it under hot pursuit?
Well, particularly, I think you look at it on a case-by-case basis, certainly, and in this case, within less than 20 minutes of a shooting, the officers have a clear understanding of who the suspect is, that he's armed, and that they have information from an eyewitness regarding where he lives, and it is in close proximity to the shooting, and the officers are able to get there.
So there is time to get a warrant.
Under these circumstances, whether it's prudent to stop and get a warrant is where the exigency comes in, because he's armed. We know where he lives. We know he lives with another individual, whether it's his mother or not. If he's an armed, dangerous suspect, based on the circumstances, then there is exigency there with respect to the officers resolving the situation as soon as they can. He's already.
And so if they'd gotten a phone call a week later saying, what's his name, Little D? Little D's back in town and he's armed and he's the one that shot the store clerk, and he's at his mother's right now, the police would be able to go into the house?
Under those circumstances, no, but
that
is certainly a different fact scenario where the officers, basically, here they know he's still armed at the time. He's just been involved in the shooting. He's a danger not only to the community, but also to any other person who may be present. So under these circumstances, given this short time window, the state's position is that there was exigency. The three criteria for exigent circumstances were established, which are protection of officers, protection of others particularly, and the prevention of the potential destruction of evidence.
What evidence?
Just the gun or potential, just potentially.
What's he going to do, flush the gun?
Your Honor, under these circumstances, with these facts, the criteria, any one of the three, even the criteria of protection of others in the community, including any other residents in the apartment.
They had an officer at the back door. They had an officer at the front door. Why couldn't they get a warrant?
Well, the defense seems to place a great deal of importance on the fact that the officers knew or had information that he lived with his mother. Certainly they knew that. The mother could have been a hostage.
What evidence was there that she was a hostage?
The fact that she was potentially, that she lived there and that she could have been present in the apartment, or any other person could have been present in the apartment. It didn't necessarily have to be the mother. There could have been other individuals in the apartment or accomplices. So under these circumstances, the officer's explanation, you know, on its face was...
What accomplices?
Potential.
I thought he went in there by himself.
We don't know that. The officers don't know that.
I thought the witnesses knew that. The witness knew that. Shorty. I thought Shorty said he came in by himself.
Oh, and in terms of potential accomplices, anyone else that maybe was involved in the crime but wasn't necessarily at the scene. Just in terms of what's in the officer's mind, what the officer's thinking. They're certainly based, I mean, that's really, it's a subjective determination, you know, on the part of the officer in terms of what put him in the position where he felt that there were circumstances that necessitated him going into the apartment without a warrant.
Well, your point is, no, there may not have been anybody in the store, but there might have been somebody driving the getaway car, there might have been a lookout, there might have been a planner.
Yes, Your Honor.
And the officers don't know that.
Yes,
On
Your
the
Honor.
Other hand, there wasn't any direct evidence that there was an accomplice.
That's true, Your Honor. But in terms of just the officer, what he was thinking at the time, the standard is whether, based on that testimony, it's sufficient to establish any one or three of the criteria that satisfy determination of whether there were exigent circumstances. However, as Justice McCoy pointed out, even if there was error on the part of the trial court, that there was no probable cause and exigent circumstances, under the facts of this case, it really is harmless because, you know, we've got two eyewitnesses, we got the eyewitness at the scene, we've got the victim, both of whom identified the appellant as the assailant, someone who was personally known to both of them.
Yeah, isn't that really the strongest point? Shorty and the clerk both knew Little D?
Well, certainly. I mean, that is, you know, not to be disrespectful, but that really is sort of a slam dunk for the state because they both
what
knew
lesson
him.
Do we learn here? Don't rob a convenience store where the
that is two blocks from where you live, certainly, where you go and you shop frequently and you get credit from the store's owner. So definitely interesting situation here.
Sort of like Bruce Callens. Went into a place where his girlfriend worked as a stripper.
Mm-hmm. Not a good idea.
And everybody thought he was joking. So he shot somebody.
Honestly, I'm sure that the fact that they knew him certainly facilitated this whole situation. Your Honor, with respect to the appellant's issues 1 through 3, the state would ask that this court would affirm the judgment of the trial court. Moving on to the fourth issue regarding whether or not appellant should have received an instruction on the factual adequacy of the search. I briefly addressed this issue, obviously. However, the state's position is that there was no contested factual issue regarding, you know, what happened. I mean, there was no contesting of whether or not there was a hostage in the home. The facts, you know, as they were presented to the court, there was no issue of facts. They were not affirmatively contested. So you don't even get to the third point of whether.
You can't go on sufficiency of, I mean, the fact that the police were speculating. And that's not enough to create an issue for the jury?
No, honestly, it isn't. That's more of a credibility determination of whether or not it was reasonable. If, you know, on his face, based on what the trial court had before him, you know, it was the trial court's position to determine whether or not the evidence was believable. There was no, and given that there was no contest of the evidence, then there's no basis for this court or for the trial court to have, you know, for this court to go behind the trial court's obvious determination that the facts were as they were in this case.
Let's say hypothetically the trial court should have given the jury charge. Under Almanza, is there any harm at all?
Again, there really is no harm because ultimately you've got a situation where you've got two eyewitnesses and you've got to the shooting, one of whom is the victim, and the defendant is someone who's personally known to both of the witnesses. So there would be no harm even under Almanza in the state's position.
Because their credibility was never really challenged, right?
Exactly. No, Your Honor. Well, if there are no further questions, the state would respectfully ask this court to affirm the judgment of the trial court.
Thank
you very much.
Bill, any rebuttal?
Very briefly, Your Honor.
I've been thinking about your question about hot pursuit. I don't know that I have an answer, but I have a few more thoughts on it.
All right.
The language that's usually used is hot or continuous pursuit. Continuance, I think, is pretty easy. I would assume that continuous would contemplate the situation where the police actually see the person that is identified as having committed the crime fleeing in some manner from the scene. So they don't lose sight of him, or at least the pursuit begins before they do. Hot pursuit might be more the situation where arriving on the scene, somebody told them, I don't know who it was, or somebody says, I do know who it was, it was little D, and he ran that way, and that happens to be the direction in which he lives. And so they immediately go after it. Here you've got a slightly, possibly distinguishable situation where they come to the store, they've got a witness that says, it was little D, and I know where he lives. And as soon as enough backup gets here, then the police take him and they go to that location. He's not seen running to the location. There's nobody that says, we saw him run in there. They surround the house, and then the rest of the events transpire. I think you can make an argument that that is not a hot pursuit. That is simply going to the location where the witness says he lives. With respect to many of these other reasons, there are a lot of might have beens, could haves, but I think the court is correct. There was no affirmative evidence that there was a hostage or an accomplice. The only affirmative evidence the police had, and if we leave the police to what might have been and what their speculations are, could be, then we have eviscerated the protections against unlawful search and seizure. Finally, with respect to the contest on whether or not there was an accomplice, the law is fairly clear that the burden of proof is on the state, and that in raising an issue, the court may consider a issue fairly raised if at any point it is brought into question by the facts in the case. I would submit that when an argument is as implausible as Officer Williams was about the hostage or accomplice in the house, that in itself entitles the defendant to a review of that fact situation and its believability and its application to the constitutional issue from the jury, not just the judge. And for that reason, I think this should have been submitted. And no other questions, I will ask
any
the court
questions?
For
all
reversal.
Right.
Thank you.
Thank you. We appreciate your argument. The case is submitted. And that is the end of our 9 o'clock docket. So we'll be in recess until our 10:30 docket is called.